You're listening to this podcast, so I know you've got a curious mind. Here's a helpful fact that you might not know yet. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive save over $900 on average. They make it super simple. Pop over to progressive.com, answer some questions, and you'll get a quick quote with coverage options tailored to your choices. Plus, you'll see which discounts you may qualify for, like the online quote discount or savings for paying in full. In fact, 99% of Progressive Auto customers earn at least one discount. See if you could save when you switch to Progressive. You'll feel good about making a savvy choice. Visit progressive.com and see if you can enjoy a little extra cash back. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $946 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2024 and May 2025. Potential savings will vary.
Let's be honest, everyone hates bank fees. The last thing I want to do is to pay to access my own money. But there's good news. Chime is changing the way people bank. They're not like traditional banks that love to gatekeep the best rewards and pile on hidden fees unless you have a massive balance. Chime offers the most rewarding fee-free banking. We're talking no overdraft fees, no monthly fees, and no minimum balance fees. And with Chime Card, you're empowered to build your credit through everyday spending, getting 5% cash back in categories of your choice. Not to mention Chime's savings rate is 9 times the national average. Join the millions who are already banking fee-free. Head to chime.com/redhanded. That's chime.com/redhanded. Sign up now. It only takes a few minutes. Chime is a fintech, not a bank. Banking services and Chime Card provided by Chime's bank partners. Qualifying direct deposits required. Terms and limits apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.
I'm Saruti.
I'm Hannah.
And welcome to Red Handed. Beyond Redemption, these were Ian Brady's last words to journalist Bob Rogers, a man he'd been in constant touch with during the latter part of his life in Ashworth Psychiatric Hospital. And while to us, this phrase may accurately describe Brady, the notorious child killer, he of course was referring not to himself, but to those who had kept him incarcerated for 51 years. Because until his death, caused by a chronic lung condition, in May 2017 at the age of 79, Brady had served half a century for the torture and murder of 5 children in Manchester, England, between 1963 and 1965. Today we are covering arguably Britain's most notorious crime, the Moors murders, so named because the bodies of the young victims who were found were discovered on the barren, remote and windswept plains of Saddleworth Moor in the Pennines in northwest England.
And if you don't have a mental image of the Moors, I've been trying to think of like a pop culture reference, and I can't think of one that's not Wuthering Heights. But if you've seen Trainspotting and that bit where Ewan McGregor just goes, "It's shite being Scottish," it's that bit. That's what the Moors looks like. And I have thought about my Scottish accent just as much as you have, and I decided I was just going to do it.
That was highly impressive. I'll give you that.
Thanks.
Do you want to do all
I can only do that sentence.
Oh.
Like just, I can only say in a Geordie accent, I can only say Paul McCartney is a total bastard.
In a Liverpudlian, all I can say is, water? Water? No?
Anyway, so if you picture that scene from Trainspotting where they're in like the desolate highlands, that's what the Moors look like. Brady spent much of his incarceration railing against his jailers and Britain as a whole. He claimed he was being abused and that his phone was being tapped by MI5. And if nothing else is clear in this case, it is Ian Brady's sense of self-importance. He was as far as you could get from a chill prisoner. The staff at Ashworth had even been force-feeding Brady from 1999 until his death 18 years later in 2017. And there really was a period of time where there was a headline every week about Ian Brady, right up until his death. And his entire time at Ashworth, he constantly campaigned to be moved to a normal prison so that he would be able to starve himself to death. Despite all this, however, he outlived his partner in crime and in life, Myra Hindley, whose involvement with the Moors murders as Brady's accomplice made her the most hated woman in Britain, a legacy she still holds despite her death in 2002.
And while many since their deaths have said that we should wipe the names of these two from our minds and from the headlines they dominated for a generation. As with most of the cases we cover, there are half-truths and misconceptions galore out there that need challenging. And also, Pauline Reed, John Kilbride, Keith Bennett, Leslie Ann Downey, and Edward Evans, the known victims of Ian Brady and Myra Hindley, certainly do not deserve to be forgotten. As we always do, before we get into the murders, we'll start with the childhoods of Ian Brady and Myra Hindley and their early lives, because it's important to understand how these two were shaped and what determined their path once they met. It's not a long story, however, in this case, because Brady was just 25 and Hindley was just 21 when they started their killing spree. That in itself is unbelievable. Most killers, as we often discuss, escalate. They start with petty crimes, burglaries, theft, and work their way up to murder. These two went straight to serial child murder. That's crazy.
Yeah, they do not fuck about.
No, absolutely no time wasting here. And although Brady and Hindley were certainly in it together, Brady was absolutely the ringleader. He was a psychopath, a sick sexual sadist and opportunistic paedophile. So let's start with Brady and his childhood, because there are a lot of misconceptions we need to clear away here.
To start right at the beginning, we need to head back to the 2nd of January 1938 in Rotten Row Maternity Hospital in Glasgow. It had been a freezing Sunday and Margaret, or Peggy Stewart, a 28-year-old single unmarried mother, gave birth to Ian Duncan Stewart. Peggy loved her son, but she just had no money, so she was forced to find him a foster family while she found full-time work. Ian's foster family were the Sloanes, who lived in the Gorbals area of Glasgow. You'll see it reported everywhere that Brady's childhood was an abusive one, where he's abandoned by his neglectful mother and put into a terrible foster home with people who abused him. Rubbish. Absolute bollocks. Peggy, his birth mother, regularly visited Ian in the Sloanes' home, and the Sloanes, Mary and John, well, they loved Ian, and they raised Ian like their own son alongside their own four children. There was no childhood head injury, and there was no abuse. He had a pretty normal childhood. But don't misunderstand us, he wasn't a normal child or teenager. All that we're saying is that his circumstances of his upbringing were incredibly unremarkable for the time.
So whatever compelled him to commit the evil acts he did cannot be easily explained away by traumas in his upbringing. Despite Peggy trying her best to provide for Ian, eventually she married a market porter named Patrick Brady, whose surname Ian would later take, and moved to Manchester. When Ian was a teenager, he visited them, and later he went to live there. Peggy never ever deserted him, and she remained unbelievably loyal to her son. Even after his conviction, she visited him in prison and at Ashworth Psychiatric Hospital, basically until her death. Now, an interesting question mark around Brady's childhood is that of animal abuse. We know that torturing animals is part of the McDonald triad and can be indicative that everything's not totally cool with your kid. You'll see, though, many places citing that Brady was killing and torturing animals as a child. And once his crimes came out, a former neighbour of the Sloanes even came forward immediately to tell newspapers that, quote, "Once Ian threw a cat out of the top floor window and boasted he had buried another cat under a gravestone because he wanted to see how long it would live."
But Brady, who only ever had one confidant whilst in prison, Dr. Alan Keatley, told him that the stories were absolute rubbish. Dr. Alan Keatley was the head of religious studies at a West Midlands sixth form college when he began writing to Ian Brady in 1992. And if you think that's a weird thing for an RE teacher to be doing, you are correct. But get this, it was at the suggestion of the mother of his youngest victim, Leslie Ann Downey. For years, Keatley visited Brady in prison every month and spoke to him on the phone almost every day and received hundreds of letters from him. And during the course of this relationship, Brady admitted to his depravity with Keatley. So why would he lie? Brady told Keatley that he was indifferent to human suffering, but that he hated cruelty to animals. He told him of a time he'd gone to the zoo and watched a boy tormenting an old tiger through the bars, and he punched the kid in the face. Which, fair, I'd say. I can't really defend that child.
Yeah, and this is the thing again with Brady. He doesn't sit in that traditional archetype of what we expect to see from a serial killer's childhood. He even told Keatley that when he and Myra were on their killing spree, they used to scan the papers for people convicted of cruelty to animals, write down their names and add them to their list of possible murder victims. The morality or moral code by which killers live is totally of their own making. They decide what's right and what's wrong, what is acceptable and what is unacceptable. So it's totally plausible that Brady could love animals while showing total indifference to the lives of humans.
And there are yet more misconceptions.
In secondary school, Brady was popular, far from the loner description we all too often see him described as. He was also academically gifted. He won a place at his secondary school, the high-flying Shorelands Academy, after getting top exam marks. And there, he became the leader of a little gang. Again, this shows his ability to lead. He's far from a little weirdo who no one likes. But he was no saint either. Brady and his gang were rowdy teenagers. They got drunk, they robbed money, they broke into people's houses. And by the age of 15, Brady already had a criminal record. And violence started to build.
He told Keatley that something would happen to him every autumn. Quote, "I felt empty and deeply depressed. Then I slowly became forgetful, so that some days, even a whole week, would become a complete blank. But when I sensed the ubiquitous ache, there was something I was compelled to do, and the first victim of my autumnal enthrallment was the police informer." This police informer was a pupil who had told the school that it was Brady and his gang who were responsible for some stealing. One day in school, Brady cornered the boy, and without saying a word, Brady said the informer, quote, "melted before me like a girl." So he pushed him to the floor and raped him. Brady said he did this devoid of any feeling or affection. It was revenge. It was about control, a trait Brady would show throughout the rest of his life.
In childhood, he portrays the typical signs of psychopathy. What's different with him is just that we don't see the abuse and mistreatment we see in the early lives of many other killers, which can often explain what triggers their genetic predisposition to violence, which does make Brady interesting in serial killer terms. But I think it's always been Myra who has truly fascinated me and horrified the nation. This is because of Myra's mugshot. You know exactly the one I'm talking about. Her with her platinum blonde hair and dead staring eyes. It became one of the most iconic photographs of the 20th century. And it's always been Myra who scared me the most.
I think it's also just to do with, she's a woman.
She's a woman and she's 21.
Yes, oh my God, that's so true. She's a 21-year-old woman. She's still basically a child almost herself, killing five children. Brady is nothing that people haven't seen before by this point. Myra is the aberration.
Yes, exactly.
And that's why we still have this intense fascination with her.
And it's a stunning photo. Like, obviously it's horrible, but like, yeah, it's such a strong image. And I think that's why it's been completely absorbed by pop culture and you see it everywhere.
And this is the thing. In that photo, you see no softness. You see no remorse. You see no guilt. You see a hard-faced woman staring back, yeah, at you, resistant and bold, almost indifferent to what she's done. That's why that photo fills people with so much rage.
So who is the lady in this famous picture? Myra was born on the 23rd of July 1942 in Crumpsall, a working-class suburb in Manchester. Here, she was brought up in a typical two-up, two-down, terraced back-to-back. She was the first child of Nellie and Bob Hindley. Her father, Bob, was away for the first 3 years of Myra's life due to the Second World War. So Myra's maternal grandmother lived with her and her mum to help raise her. When Bob returned home, he found work doing menial labour, and he started to drink heavily. He also started to hit his wife. But by all accounts, Nellie gave as good as she got. And this is where we start to see the first misconceptions about Myra's life. That she was terribly abused and led an incredibly volatile childhood. Well, actually, Myra had an incredibly ordinary childhood. Yes, her father drank too much and was abusive. But for the time and place, Myra's upbringing was pretty ordinary.
And what's vitally important to note is that this is not the background we see in serial killers. And actually, when her younger sister Maureen was born, when Myra was about four, Myra went to live with her grandmother, whom she loved and who lived just down the street from her parents. Again, this wasn't so crazy for the time, and living with her grandmother meant that Myra wasn't even around her drunk of a dad all the time. I'm sure there was definitely some maltreatment and emotional deprivation, but nothing at all like what we see in the backgrounds of other serial killers. Nothing in Myra's childhood could have predicted what she would become.
Even at school, Myra was totally unremarkable. Not a gifted child or particularly academic or bright, but certainly not stupid. But Myra was tough. Her father was a brawler and he taught Myra to always fight back. She'd often get into fights with local boys and was fiercely protective of her sister Maureen. Myra was also a staunch Catholic who regularly attended her local church, the monastery at St. Francis. Even members of her own family described her as extremely pious. And at 17, Myra became engaged to a local boy and her childhood sweetheart,
Ronnie Sinclair. She honestly was a total product of her time and place, but do not let this trick you into thinking that Myra was just a normal girl. She was incredibly easily bored. She had a normal life, but it was far from what she wanted. After she left school, she tried many different jobs, but nothing could keep her interested.
Nothing, that was, until January 1961, when at 18 years old, Myra got a job as a typist in Millwards, a Lancashire wholesale chemical distributor in Gorton, Manchester. And this was where she met a curious 21-year-old Glaswegian man named Ian Brady. And boom, Myra was captivated. She described Brady as the only man she had ever met with clean fingernails.
Low standards, Myra. Low, low standards.
I think we just cannot overstate her almost immediate feelings towards Brady. And I think, you know, the whole clean fingernails thing, all of that, I think it's just because Brady was just so totally different to every other person she'd ever known in her very blue-collar upbringing. Brady listened to classical music and jazz and read strange books, a particular favourite of his being Mein Kampf, in its original German. He was a pseudo-intellectual, and by all accounts, an olden days hipster wanker. But she was into it.
I bet, I absolutely would bet any money he's one of those wankers who's like, if you're going to listen to that album, you have to listen to it with headphones.
Absolutely, you can say, if you're going to listen to that album, you have to listen to it in its original Russian and on vinyl.
Yeah, that's exactly the type of person.
That's exactly who he is. You all know a person like him. Maybe not, he's a serial killing psychopath, but you all know at this point who Ian Brady is.
But yeah, Myra, into it for some ridiculous reason. And she even kept an even more ridiculously childish diary of her love for Brady, writing things like, Ian was mad today, Ian ignored me today, Ian wore a black shirt and looked smashing.
I don't think we use that enough to describe each other anymore these days, you know how?
Smashing?
You look smashing today. Great, let's bring it back.
Shall we try?
Let's make it a thing.
Let's give ourselves a week to see if we can bring smashing
back. Okay, I like it. I'm in.
And the more time she spent with Brady, the more everything in her life, including her fiancé Ronnie, screamed of banality.
Poor Ronnie. This guy.
I know.
Poor Ronnie. You know Ronnie, like, works in a factory. He's probably got dirty fingernails. He doesn't understand jazz or classical music. He's certainly not reading Mein Kampf in German. He's just a normal dude.
I have a theory that Ian Brady didn't understand German at all. He was just
looking at it.
Reading it.
He was just looking at
the words.
But Brady was very smart. He was very, very intelligent.
I would like to think he was just looking at it.
It makes me feel better to think he was just looking at it.
So poor Ronnie, eventually Myra does end it. And all to pursue the aloof Brady. And Brady finally noticed her. In December, at the Christmas party, he asked her to dance. He then walked her home, where they shared their first kiss. When on their first date, he took her to the film The Nuremberg Trials. And while you or I may run away from a date like that, not Myra, not even a date, a first date. Can you imagine?
That's a film about Nazis being hanged.
Just run for the hills.
Run away, run away. But no, she's good.
Yeah, Myra loved it. She was actually thrilled because now she knew she would never be bored again. Brady started to mould her into the woman he wanted, and she eagerly devoured the reading lists that he made her.
Brady was a big fan of Nietzsche, a philosopher who insisted that there are no rules for human life, no absolute values, no certainties on which to rely.
Nietzsche is the number one wanker philosopher. Like, if you meet a wanker, they will know about Nietzsche. If anyone quotes Nietzsche to me in conversation, I will leave the room. I cannot stand it.
I've met someone with a tattoo. Quote.
Fuck off.
Yeah. So that's when you really know, because they've branded themselves with how much of a dickhead they are. But yeah, this was Brady. And we can see Brady's worldview was shaped around such thoughts as Nietzsche proposed, such as the idea that if truth can be achieved at all, it can only come from the individual who purposefully disregards everything that is traditionally taken to be important. It is a super nihilistic worldview, and Brady clings on to it. He loves the idea that such a superhuman person is the only one who can truly live an authentic and successful human life. This was what Brady believed, and this is what Brady wanted Myra to understand. So Myra read Nietzsche, and when Brady told Myra there was no God, this formerly devout Catholic stopped
stopped going to church completely.
I'm always fascinated by people who are just able to turn off religion.
Or turn on.
Yeah, like such a snap judgment. My entire paradigm has shifted because of one sentence that somebody has said. I'm not going to do any critical engagement with this. I just think differently now.
And that's exactly what she does. She's like, oh, okay then. No more church. Off.
Yeah, see you later, God. Thanks for the memories.
Yeah. And I wonder, actually, with Myra, though, everybody said she was very devout, that she was very pious. She was even more so than the rest of her family. So it wasn't like it was being forced upon her by them. And that's why she was that way. I've seen Myra described in a lot of places as enchanted by the brutal. And we certainly see that's true with her relationship with Brady. Do you think she was so into the Catholic Church because a lot of the Bible and a lot of the stuff you learn about is very, very bloody and very brutal? Was that why she was so into it?
Good point. It's a difficult one because I don't know what the Catholic Church was like in the 60s. Like, my experience of the Catholic Church is obviously in like the 90s and early 2000s, where there's just this disappearance of hell and no one really talks about it. And no one talks about the devil either. But you kind of know it's there, but it's never discussed. But I wonder whether in the 60s it might have been a little bit more fire and brimstone.
I reckon it might have been a little bit more fire and brimstone during the 60s. And also, Myra is easily bored. She's definitely drawn towards the brutal and drawn towards like violence and even just imagery, I think, of this kind of thing. Wouldn't have been as easily accessible to her then. She didn't have the internet. She couldn't just like watch American Horror Story or whatever and get it out of her system. Maybe the church filled that gap. And then when Brady came along and introduced her to things like the Nazis and all the other stuff he pulls into her sphere of existence, maybe that's why she was able to switch that side of her off so quickly. I don't know. Just a thought I had while I was doing the research.
And the pair would hang out listening to recordings of Hitler's speeches in the original German, of course.
On vinyl, of course.
On vinyl with headphones. Or Myra would listen as Brady read aloud from Mein Kampf. That is the pinnacle of wankerdom. I really can't get over that.
It's just one step up from like making me go to like a fucking poetry reading. I'm going to say, you won't come to a poetry reading. Okay, you're going to sit and listen while I read Mein Kampf aloud.
He doesn't have any originality of his own. Like, everything he's talking about is someone else's ideology. He borrows from lots of different places. He can't write these things himself. He can't come up with original ideas. So he just steals it and is like, oh, look how amazing I am.
He's very, very derivative. But we do see with all the journals that he keeps that I think he thinks he was creating some sort of like historical manifesto of meaning, but it's all bollocks. None of it is original.
And Myra even dyed her brown hair that famous bright shade of blonde, no doubt, again, for Brady's pleasure, because she looked like a female SS guard.
She genuinely does. The bitch of Birkenau. She looks like that.
As their bond grew, Brady encouraged Myra to read the works of the sexual sadist, the Marquis de Sade. He was obsessed by these books. And they're full of stories of rape and torture and sexual dominance. Stories in which the worse it was, the better it was. And whatever his fantasy, Myra would indulge Brady. She posed for his pornographic pictures, and when Brady told her that true supreme pleasure was gained from the rape and murder of another, she seemed completely fine with this. As their relationship progressed, Myra became tougher, posher and more flamboyant. But she seemed happy with Brady. They were always out together in her car. They'd regularly picnic on Saddleworth Moor. And they even had a dog called Puppet. I don't know why that unnerves me, but it really, really does. What a horrible name for a dog.
I actually thought it was quite a cute name. It's a really cute dog.
Or maybe I'd feel better if I saw a picture
of it. I'll show you a picture. It's a border collie.
Okay. Still though, I don't know. There's something about that that makes me uncomfortable.
If Brady named it, it's almost like what he thought of Myra as well.
Exactly.
It creates some powerful imagery around that anyway.
You're listening to this podcast, so I know you've got a curious mind. Here's a helpful fact that you might not know yet. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive save over $900 on average. They make it super simple. Pop over to progressive.com, answer some questions, and you'll get a quick quote with coverage options tailored to your choices. Plus, you'll see which discounts you may qualify for, like the online quote discount or savings for paying in full. In fact, 99% of Progressive Auto customers earn at least one discount. See if you could save when you switch to Progressive. You'll feel good about making a savvy choice. Visit progressive.com and see if you can enjoy a little extra cash back. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $946 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2024 and May 2025. Potential savings will vary.
Let's be honest, everyone hates bank fees. The last thing I want to do is to pay to access my own money. But there's good news. Chime is changing the way people bank. They're not like traditional banks that love to gatekeep the best rewards and pile on hidden fees unless you have a massive balance. Chime offers the most rewarding fee-free banking. We're talking no overdraft fees, no monthly fees, and no minimum balance fees. And with Chime Card, you're empowered to build your credit through everyday spending, getting 5% cash back in categories of your choice. Not to mention Chime's savings rate is 9 times the national average. Join the millions who are already banking fee-free. Head to chime.com/redhanded. That's chime.com/redhanded. Sign up now. It only takes a few minutes. Chime is a fintech, not a bank. Banking services and Chime Card provided by Chime's bank partners. Qualifying direct deposits required. Terms and limits apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.
Does anyone else feel like August is the Sunday of summer? It's the perfect time to hit reset before the autumn rush. And for me, that always starts with my wardrobe. Quince specializes in effortless, high-quality essentials like ultra-soft organic cotton and premium stretch denim. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Because they work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middleman, you're paying for actual quality instead of brand markup. Their leather handbags are gorgeous and honestly just as good quality as designer names. I find myself reaching for Quince accessories as the perfect finishing touch for pretty much all of my outfits. Upgrade your everyday. Go to quince.com/redhanded for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK too. That's quince.com/redhanded for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/redhanded.
By June 1963, the couple were living together in Myra's grandmother's house on Bannock Street, and this is where they first began to discuss committing the perfect crime. Brady told her it would be a bank robbery, so she learned to drive and got a car, and even got the guns that Brady demanded. Brady, however, wasn't planning a bank robbery at all, but this proved to him that Myra would do whatever he asked, and anyway, the guns and the car and the ability to drive that she now had also made her more valuable for his real plans. And I think the way Brady saw Myra was that he relished in the idea of this control he could have over her. The fact that this tough woman, because she was tough, she was known in the area of being incredibly strong, fighting, she was brawling in the street, she wouldn't let anybody walk all over her. And he loved the fact that this tough woman was willing to change everything and hang on his every word. That would have been orgasmic for someone like Brady. And Brady knew the value of this. He had found in Myra a woman who would enable him to live out his most vile fantasies. He needed her.
And he needed her fully on board with murder. So he moves away from the bank robbery and brings up the idea of the two of them committing the perfect murder. Brady told Myra to choose anyone. It wouldn't matter because it would be, quote, an existential experience of sheer will, a sacrifice. That is the most pretentious sentence I've ever said in my life. Existential experience, as a phrase, would be used again and again by Brady to describe their crimes. Existentialism as a philosophy emphasizes and prioritizes individual existence, freedom, and choice. Again, this links to the philosophy that has become fused in the psychopathic mind of Brady, that it was up to him to define the meaning of his own life, and it was up to him to find the freedom to become that superhuman man who lives outside the parameters of what we mere mortals deem acceptable.
I'm better than this. I'm more special than this. If I lead an ordinary life that is dictated to by what all of you, very average, ordinary, normal people deem acceptable, and this makes you happy, how could I possibly gain that same satisfaction from living your mundane lives?
Yeah, you can't control me with your silly little laws. It's that level of arrogance.
Definitely, that's exactly what it is. And why Brady's childhood is so interesting, why both of their childhoods are so interesting, is because the external forces acting on them were so neutral. Neutral for the time and place they were born and raised. If you were going to do an experiment to identify what creates serial killers, this would almost be a control childhood. Two people potentially predisposed to psychopathy who grew up under circumstances not a million miles away from what many of their peers would have experienced. At the ages of just 25 and 21, kidnapped, tortured, and killed 5 children. When compared to the likes of Fred and Rose West, this is remarkable. If you haven't listened to our episodes on the West, definitely do. The childhoods experienced by that particular sexually sadistic serial killing couple were quite different. And while it never excused what they did, it perhaps goes some way to explaining their crimes. Their early years were filled with unbelievable sexual abuse and violence, and they both had clear underlying cognitive and mental issues. Both Myra and Brady always fitted in, excelled even, but still this dark something bubbled just beneath the surface with both of them, and they decided now to act out one of these existential experiences.
On Friday the 12th of July 1963, Pauline Reed, a 16-year-old trainee baker, was heading out to go to a dance at the Railway Workers' Social Club just 10 minutes' walk from her home in the Gorton district of Manchester. Pauline left her house at around 7:45 that evening wearing a pink and gold party dress and a brand new pair of white stilettos. She was going to the dance on her own because none of her friends could make it, but Pauline was determined to go. So her mum waved her off and told her to have a good time. But Pauline would never make it to the dance. And as we heard last week, many of Pauline's remains only made it home to her family this month, 55 years after she was murdered. As Pauline headed towards her party, Myra was on the hunt.
She approached Pauline, and it was easy because the two of them even sort of knew each other, at least by sight, because Pauline Reed was a friend of Myra's sister's boyfriend, Dave Smith, who will incidentally play a very important role in the story later on, so remember that name. Myra tells Pauline that she's distraught because she'd lost her very expensive glove on Saddleworth Moor. She asked if Pauline would please come with her and help her find it. And Pauline, I think she was early for this dance, and I guess she was going solo, so maybe she was looking for some time to kill. Myra also sweetened the deal by promising Pauline some records as a reward if she helped her. Brady was waiting. Myra wanted to deliver, so she picked an easy target, as they kind of knew each other, and she was willing to say whatever she had to get Pauline to go with her.
As Myra was securing their victim, Brady was getting ready at home. He armed himself with a knife and put on surgical gloves under his leather ones. And with that, he got on his motorbike and rode to Gorton. The method of communication that these two had decided was that if Myra had failed to grab a victim, she'd park her car visibly in a specific location in town. It wasn't there, so Brady knew it was on. He sped to the moor. Years later, when recounting the murder of Pauline Reed, he would say, "No one who saw me ride past them that night could have guessed what I was about to do. It was unfolding before their eyes, but how could they know? For me, it was the beginning of an existential exercise beyond good and evil. The streets of Manchester were the backdrop for the scene to which my destiny had been taking me all these years. Was I about to step through the final doorway to madness, or had I already entered it long ago? I recoiled at the idea." He is such a pretentious dickhead. He said he brushed away any last-minute jitters with "Richard's himself again," his catchphrase about himself linking him to the evil King Richard III, who put the princes in the tower, we think, can't prove it. And he also recalled the sheer joy and anticipation that he felt as he rode to the moors, wondering who Myra had got, a boy or a girl. Literally like when you do online shopping for yourself and you wait for the surprise at home. He wanted the thrill of the surprise, and Myra wanted to deliver.
When Brady arrived on the moor, he joined Hindley and Pauline, saying he was there to help with the glove search. The couple had rehearsed this. They knew where to go. They led Pauline into a remote part of the moor, not visible from the road. And here, Brady struck. He pounced and grabbed Pauline by the throat, forcing her to the ground. I can only imagine the fear and shock that would have hit Pauline. As she lay on the ground with Brady holding her down, she pleaded with Myra, crying, "Please tell him to stop." But instead, Myra Hindley knelt on the grass and unbuttoned Pauline's coat. She then forced her to sit up and pulled off her coat and unzipped her dress and removed her bra. Hindley then sexually assaulted 16-year-old Pauline Reed, all the while watching Brady to ensure it was turning him on. Eventually, Brady joined in, and the pair raped and abused Pauline on that desolate moor. As daylight faded and they were done, Brady told Pauline to get dressed.
But if the couple thought this would be the perfect romantic activity for them, things were about to fall apart. As Pauline reached for a gold medallion brooch she'd been wearing, Hindley snatched it from her, saying, "You won't need that where you're going." Brady, furious that she was giving the game away, slapped Myra hard at this remark. But Myra told him she only said it because she was worried that he wouldn't go through with it and kill Pauline. And this was when she told Brady that she needed Pauline dead because she knew her. She was her sister's boyfriend's friend, after all. Brady was apoplectic.
This was a stupid mistake on Myra's part. You never pick a victim, you know.
So Brady left the pet and went back to the car to get their kill kit. By the time he returned, Myra had attacked Pauline with a knife. She had tried to stab her in the chest, but the knife had broken and not even penetrated Pauline. So Myra had punched Pauline repeatedly in the head. I think to Brady, this would have been too risky. And also to Brady, I think this would have been a bit too inelegant. So he stepped in and slashed Pauline's neck. Pauline Reed was dead in minutes. They dug a shallow grave and buried Pauline where she died, before returning home to burn all of their clothes. They then dumped the ashes and the knife in a river and thoroughly scrubbed the car and bike.
Brady was incredibly far ahead of his time in terms of forensics. He took no chances. He'd done his best to cover their tracks and cover up for the mistakes Myra had made, but he knew they had to wait and see what happened before they could even think about doing it again. But as we already know, they would do it again, 4 more times, which is where we will pick up next week.
It's going to get really heavy next week. A lot of in-depth talk around, as you guessed it, 4 more child murders.
Be prepared, and thank you for joining us for our 50th episode, half a century.
Crazy. On one hand, it feels crazy that it's 50 episodes. On the other hand, it feels like we've done a lot more.
That's so true, actually. I'd never thought about it like that. I feel like I've been doing this since the dawn of time.
But we haven't. We've been doing it for about 11 months now. So not even a year, Hannah.
That's bonkers.
And I still remember that first day we put up our podcast. We couldn't figure out how to get the image to upload onto Podbean because the sizes were wrong.
Yeah.
So we were calling my dad to get him to do it. Oh my god, the drama. We were sat in your kitchen in your old flat trying to get it all to upload. We had to decide on the subscription level that we wanted for Podbean, which is the provider we're using at the time to host us. And it was like, should we go for a year?
Let's just see how it goes.
Let's just start with a month.
Person I don't know very well at all.
Let's start with a month subscription. And then we went up to a 3-month subscription. Yeah, because it felt like a huge commitment at the time. Not paying for 12 months if we're going to just fuck about with one episode and not do this anymore. But here we are. We've weathered the stormy podcast seas.
Still feels quite stormy sometimes.
It certainly does. But no, it's all thanks to you guys. Thank you so much for listening and making this year as fucking amazing as it's been.
And if you'd like to come and have a pint.
Yes.
We're going to be in the Silver Cross on Whitehall on the 16th of June from about 6 o'clock. It's the London True Crime Meetup. There'll be other podcasts there. So come down and have a drink if you're in town.
Absolutely. We'd love to meet you.
And we will have some prizes this time, unlike last time.
Definitely.
When we were drastically underprepared.
Well, we'd been going for like 2 months at that point. We didn't think anybody even knew who we were.
That's true.
Definitely come do that. Also, be sure to follow us on all the social medias at Red Handed the Pod. That's Instagram, Twitter, and on Facebook.
And if you would like to give us some money to help us run the show, you can do that at patreon.com/redhanded. It makes such a difference. We genuinely couldn't keep doing the show without it. And here are some people who have already helped us out.
Lana13. Kathleen Noble, Rebecca Knight, Ray Gaithier, Laura Geiger, Kelly, Sarah Peel, Luke Matthew Sutton, Elizabeth Morris, Lisa Alaya, Frances Beswick, and Ashley Chatnick. Thank you very much, guys.
It makes such an enormous difference.
Definitely, we will see you next week when we go back to the Moors for Moors Murders Part 2.
See you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Your vehicle doesn't just get you from here to there. It's a bridge to the people and places that matter most. It's how you show up for your family, your community, and everyone else that depends on you. That's why for 125 years, Firestone has been building tires with one thing in mind: to deliver products that are as reliable as you are. Firestone, always dependable since 1900.
Good news! Goodwill Columbus has opened a new store in Westerville. And with a new donation center, it's easier than ever to make a difference in your community. Bring your gently used clothing, furniture, electronics, and more to our donation drop-off. Each donation and purchase supports our mission to provide jobs, free job training, essential services, and more right here in Westerville. Drop your donations off at 60 East Schrock Road or learn more at goodwillcolumbus.org.
Ever thought about Botox but worried you'll look, well, overdone? You're not alone. That's exactly why so many people choose Caps. Their approach is all about keeping your expression natural because Botox shouldn't freeze your face. It should refresh it. At CAPS, treatments are performed by licensed nurses known for precise and subtle refined enhancements, all overseen by nationally ranked plastic surgeons. Now's the perfect time to start Botox. Book your first appointment and receive a $50 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Schedule today at experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.